Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Toby Miller, who is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Toby Miller.
It's good to be with you.
And the Academy Awards appear to have favored this year, I guess it's a sci-fi film, Gravity, that won most of the awards. And the films that didn't win any or any significant ones were American Hustle, Nebraska, and The Wolf of Wall Street, all of which had fairly prominent and unequivocal political and cultural themes. So I'm wondering about what this is saying about the Academy and its take on popular culture.
Well, the first thing I'd say to that is that we need to acknowledge that the Academy did recognize the importance of 12 Years a Slave, and that in and of itself is very political because of its take on U.S. history and contemporaneity. And, of course, it's notable that the director said last night that he wanted us to think about not just surviving but living, and he wanted us to think in particular of the over 21 million people enslaved today. But it's true that other than that, the political films that you mentioned were not really touched on with favor by the Academy. And obviously, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is comprised of high-level professionals who are upper middle class in many cases, though not all of them. They frequently have quite high educational attainment. They are probably liberal in many cases when it comes to cultural politics of sex, of race, of sexuality, gender, and so forth. They may be reasonably liberal economically, but are they really people who are prepared to look at the institutionalized graft and corruption of everyday American life and the systematic inequality of class that pervades it, perhaps not with quite the same interest that they are to looking at science fiction or with the way in which they're prepared to acknowledge the racism of the country?
Well, I thought Nebraska was one of the most powerful indictments of red state rural America in the sense that it almost portrayed a dead zone, a cultural, spiritual, and material dead zone where these sad characters are chasing a chimera of the American dream.
Well, of course, that's a long-standing theme in Hollywood, the desire for the American dream and the improbability of ever quite attaining it. And there's also a long-standing tendency in popular culture to think about the Midwest as, on the one hand, the real heartland of the country, where real Americans live, unlike people like you and me who have tended to reside on the coasts, but also for it to be regarded as, in a sense, a hopeless case. And there is a very Depression-era-style narrative that frequently makes the play. And, of course, you think about Nebraska in the context of Death of a Salesman, a long-standing capacity on the part of American culture, regardless of its geographical location, to invest in the dream in ways that see a particular kind of masculinity, particularly white masculinity, tripping, stumbling, and falling. But whether or not now is the time to be celebrating that tragedy, just when the country appears, at least in part, to be pulling out of the recession, may be one of the factors militated against Nebraska. Well, now, in the case of American Hustle, I wonder what you thought about that, since it clearly is also something that is a startling indictment, but not just of red state America, of every state America.
And indeed, it is also, I think, at least inequality, which is very much the theme or at least the subtext of The Wolf of Wall Street, and the extent to which the oligarchs have bought our politics is, I think, very clear in American Hustle. I think those things are in the zeitgeist.
I think that's absolutely true, and of course they have been for a very long time. The great challenge is always to take the negativity of a depiction of corruption and then turn it into something more positive, rather than have it simply feed the nihilistic notion that there's no point in politics, that everybody's out for themselves, everybody's corrupt, and no one is motivated by altruism. And one of the interesting things about American Hustle is that there are characters within it who certainly are flawed and are corrupt, but who are not just that, who are trying to be something else, something different, but for whom this is part of everyday politics. So the character played by Jeremy Renner, who is the local mayor in New Jersey, the mayor of Camden, is on the take in the interest of his family, but is genuinely pan-racial and cross-class in his desire to better the lives of the people who make up the city that he runs, in inverted commas, and is even, in a sense, entrapped, despite his reluctance to be involved in corruption in certain ways. And, you know, the protagonist of the film, in many ways, the mastermind of all of this, is the guy who, in the end, wishes to do something altruistic to minimize the damage done to the mayor of Camden. And that Christian Bale character, the mastermind, sets himself up from the beginning of the film as a first-person narrator, as someone who is only out for himself, but that's not actually the case. He learns a certain humility and decency along the way. So one of the things about it is that in addition to its negativity, there is a positive side to it, rather like what you would get with a New Deal era film in the 30s and 40s, where Frank Capra, though a determined Republican, nevertheless saw the need to give the possibility of redemption and decency in amongst the fallibility of politics. Wolf of Wall Street, of course, a very, very contemporary picture, in that at one level it's something that you could associate with what you saw in the Michael Douglas Wall Street, Greed is Good, Gordon Gekko character, and certainly it has all the Reagan-era hallmarks. On the other, it's, of course, something that we've seen nonstop with the neoliberal domination of political economic life, basically since the end of the Carter administration, you know, whether the president's name is Obama or Clinton or Bush, and that notion of get rich quick and devil take the hindmost, with lots of drugs, lots of parties, lots of girls, lots of boys, is something that lots of us find really quite appealing, even as there's a countervailing aspect to it that is distasteful. And again, though, I think it's done in a contradictory and quite interestingly dialectical way. After all, the United States is certainly a country that stands for hedonism in the world's imagination. Otherwise, how could it be such a massive consumer of drugs? On the other hand, it stands in the world's imagination as the symbol of some kind of entirely mad Christian rectitude. So those schizoid responses to the stimulus of capitalism and the prospects of the new world are undoubtedly interesting, very dialectical moments of encounter in Wolf of Wall Street and in American Hustle.
Well, indeed, it does. I've always thought that America has a schizophrenia between piety and porn. But again,
well put.
Again, I'm speaking with Toby Miller, who is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connections to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. Let's turn to we're talking about films that didn't get the awards in the Academy Awards, the 2013 Academy Awards that just took place. In terms of documentary features, there were some very political documentary features this year, and they conspicuously did not win Dirty War and The Square about Tahrir Square, and Dirty Wars, of course, about JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command. They failed, and a film about backup singers won. Any significance to that in terms of our conversation?
Well, I think it's great that they even got nominated. Jeremy Scahill, who is the Enos, not particularly grease, behind Dirty Wars, is a radical journalist in the United States firmament. He's obviously very important in terms of his writing for places like The Nation and also his radio journalism. And the fact that somebody with his take on the corruption and the imperialism endemic in the U.S. military project says something about the capacity of the Academy, particularly those people involved in documentary, to recognize both the qualities of the picture but also the urgency of people being urged to address such questions. So I think we can say at least it was on the list, and it's a radical enterprise in itself. In the case of The Square, this is a very interesting instance. Obviously, it's dealing in very complicated ways with the extraordinary phenomenon of the so-called Arab Spring. I say so-called because it's gone on for such a long time, but it's also been interrupted in so many ways. And this is also interesting because not only is that a phenomenally complicated political place and moment, far beyond the ken of most of us who don't speak Arabic and have ethnographic experience as well as historical knowledge there, it's also very innovative in terms of its life story as a motion picture, as a documentary, because it's a Netflix film, and as such was quite regularly updated over the period of the last couple of years to stay, you know, in tune with events. That's not something that you could do with documentaries before, but because of the way Netflix produces them, you can now. That makes it a complicated aesthetic object, a bit like the way in which different versions of Leni Riefenstahl's Olympia or even Orson Welles' Citizen Kane change over time as different versions are released in different countries at different moments or a cut or whatever. Here we have a motion picture that is constantly being updated as the political crisis in Egypt evolves, and also one where, you know, we see in this case one of the major figures in the film unable to come to the United States, unable to leave Egypt as a consequence of the political regime's view of his activities. It may well be that rather than this being a slight on the politics of the film, it's also partly that some voters in the Academy aren't quite sure what to make of this. This is such a dynamic, open-ended story, one that is constantly being re-edited, renovated, reconsidered. That, you know, what is the version you're actually contemplating? Where does it end? How does it cut off? And how do you define it? And I think that shows that we're in a moment of both technological and political economic change where an entity like Netflix is not only coming to challenge the way in which broadcast and cable and satellite television function in the United States, but is also redefining our notion of when a film begins and ends.
Well, there's no question that Netflix, its model of making television in terms of House of Cards, where they just write a check to the filmmakers and leave them alone, is entirely in contrast with how these corporate bureaucracies operate, with legions of vice presidents vetting scripts and giving their ridiculous script notes to directors and micromanaging casting, etc. And we end up with the kind of dreck that we have on television and in movies, contrasting to some of the really interesting stuff that's coming out on television now, like House of Cards. So I don't imagine the corporate bureaucracies are going to change and going to suddenly fire all of their legions of vice presidents.
Well, of course, it's not only a matter of cutting out some of the bureaucracy. It's also giving us as viewers great deal more autonomy in that not only can the people who make House of Cards get cut a check, but we get cut a lot of slack in that once we've made the purchase from Netflix, we can watch every bloody episode in a row if we want to. Not something that is seizable with broadcast or cable or satellite television until at least one season has already been run through. So that's a remarkable thing too, and we may see lots of changes in the definition of what counts as a film as part of that.
Sure.
And of course, funding regimes matter and change also. Many of the motion pictures that get nominated, for instance, for Best Foreign Film are essentially funded with television money. even though we don't see them in that way. I mean, the whole world of new German cinema, people will remember from the 1980s, the world that made the names of Wim Wenders and Fassbinder renowned to so many of us, may have been seen in universities and on festival circuits in the United States or in Western Europe or in Latin America, but in Germany, those movies were seen on television because that was what, how they were funded. And the sobriquet New German Cinema was, in a sense, a laughable term. It was New German Television. So there are lots of complicated definitional questions for us to consider. And, you know, the requirement that films must have theatrical release in order to count to be nominated and then voted for in the Oscars, a theatrical release within a certain window, maybe something that we see as a hangover from the 20th century that no longer applies. We'll mm-hmm. see. I think there are, just as there are all kinds of shifts that occur in the nature of the awards, so the very definition of the awards may be under challenge.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let me give you my most surreal moment from the Academy Awards, and then I'll ask, then you can offer yours. I thought the most surreal moment was when Lupita Nyong'o won the Best Actress in a Supporting Role for 12 Years a Slave when she got up to get her award suddenly out of nowhere. Liza Minnelli, who clearly didn't know this woman, rushes up and hugs her. So what was your most surreal moment?
Yes, that was an interesting one. I think for me, it's the selfie. And the, in other words, the, right. the self-taken photograph that, you know, smashed Twitter records and showed that a selfie taken at the Oscars can matter more than President Obama on Twitter. It also shows that the very beautifully and professionally done photography everywhere from the Oscars themselves to the after parties takes a back footing, a back seat to what celebrities do themselves. And I wonder whether the dominant still photograph of Oscar season will not be the cover of Vanity Fair or any of the photographs taken at the Vanity Fair party, but rather the one taken by Ellen DeGeneres with all her, in inverted commas, friends. That's a telling moment of narcissism that both American culture, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, are well renowned for.
Well, Toby Miller, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Toby Miller, who is one of the world's leading analysts of popular culture, media, and their connection to the politics of everyday life. His books include Cultural Citizenship, How Conservatives and Neoliberals Capture the Cultural Politics of Television and How We Can Take It Back, Makeover Nation, The United States of Reinvention, Greening the Media, and Blow Up the Humanities. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.